Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Stephen Strogatz. Strogatz is the Jacob Gould Sherman Professor of Applied Mathematics at Cornell University. He received his PhD from Harvard University, and before coming to Cornell, he was on the faculty of MIT. He is a frequent guest on NPR's Radio Lab and a guest columnist for the New York Times. He is also the author of several well-received books, including the best-selling trade book, Sync. His most recent is titled The Calculus of Friendship, What a Teacher and Student Learned About Life While Corresponding About Math, and it was published by the Princeton University Press. And welcome to the show, Steve.
Thank you, Tish.
Now, you mentioned in your book how you, in first grade, when your class went to the library, you would always check out the How and Why Wonder Book of Atomic Energy. Do you remember what got you so involved in mathematics at such a young age?
I really can't explain it. I mean, there was nothing like this in my family. My dad had, and so did my aunt, some training in being accountants, but they never ended up doing that. They worked in the shoe business. So
it just came out of the blue.
I don't really know where it came from. And in fact, my parents used to discourage me a little bit and say, you know, why don't you read a different book? Next week you could get a different book or read a story. My mother would always say, why don't you read a story? But there was something about this atomic energy book and the idea of splitting atoms and the atomic bomb. You know, this is a six-year-old boy's idea of what's interesting.
That's amazing. So were you actually into numbers at that point? Or were you reading the book and just reading about the theory?
There were no numbers in that book. This was just stories of big explosions, and you had to imagine going inside the atom and things that's so small you couldn't see them. It was that. It was the science side. But math was not really any particular interest of mine until much later. It was more just science and bugs and lightning and gems and things like that.
Uh-huh. Well, when did you actually graduate from, you know, the general education of subtraction and addition and so on and start really getting into deep math?
I would say there was a pivotal moment in high school. I had a high school geometry teacher who, actually, he wasn't teaching geometry, come to think of it. It was a different course. It was the next course after trigonometry and pre-calculus. And he mentioned just offhandedly one day that there was a question about triangles that he had never seen any student solve, and he himself didn't know how to do it.
Mm.
And this really caught my attention because I never heard a teacher say before that they didn't know how to do something.
Yeah.
And it made me start thinking about this question, and it got to a point where I would think about it every day, including in French class or if I was in the gym, you know, someone was passing me the basketball, I would hit me on the knee because I was thinking about the stupid triangle problem. And what was happening, in fact, was that I was doing research. I didn't know that it was called research. I was just couldn't stop thinking about this question, but that was probably the beginning.
And you ended up solving it and showing it to the teacher? Is that the way?
Something like that, yeah. So after about 6 months of thinking about it, I had an idea for how to solve it, and I thought I had solved it and called him up on a Sunday morning. He lived pretty close. This was a boarding school. I was at a Loomis Chafee in Windsor, Connecticut. So I was boarding there, and he lived on the outskirts of where the school was. And so I went on a Sunday morning. I can picture him in his pajamas with his kids, and I showed him this proof of this triangle question, and he checked it step by step, and he finally said, "Yep, you got it."
Wow, that must have been an amazing moment for both of you.
Well, maybe so. I'm not so sure how much it was for him, but it was for me. And I caught the bug at that point. I found myself making up questions like that one just to have the pleasure of trying to think about them and solve them.
So you found that this was the only thing that was really engaging your mind?
Well, I wouldn't go that far. I mean, there were girls. This was high school. And, you know, there were lots of interesting things. I also had a course in short story that I liked very much. And high school was a very, very wonderful time for me. I know a lot of people find high school tedious, and I was lucky in that somehow there were good teachers, or maybe I just got in the right courses. So, yeah, it was.
You found your passion as well, it looks like.
Yeah, there were lots of passions, but math was certainly one of them.
Yeah. Now, you described calculus as the mathematical study of change. Can you talk at all about that to the layperson?
Sure, yeah. Well, you know, if you think about math, there's counting, arithmetic, there's geometry. We're used to circles and lines and triangles. But, you know, nothing really changes in geometry. It's just static shapes on the page, and you discuss their properties. But nothing's moving particularly or changing or evolving. And so the first time that you get to that, and certainly in algebra, it's very abstract with just X's and Y's and who really knows what they stand for.
Mm-hmm.
But calculus puts all the X's and Y's and the shapes of geometry together and numbers into a kind of a whirlwind of motion and change. It's the subject, the first subject, that lets us deal with literally things moving through space, you know, particles or balls falling through the air or planets orbiting the sun,
mm-hmm.
but other things that can change too, like economies, the ups and downs of the stock market, the rise and fall of populations in an ecosystem. Pretty much everything on Earth and in the universe and in our bodies changes. And mm-hmm. so it's only through calculus that you can come to grips with those.
And do you think of change? Do you think of numbers when you think of change? I mean, I think of paintings and photography and, you know, and stories and
yes,
history. But do you think of numbers?
I guess I was thinking about numbers, yes. Right, stories and relationships, it's hard to put numbers on those.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But something like populations of fish in a pond, you know, there's a certain number of fish. That's a number.
Uh-huh.
And it's going to change over time as those fish get eaten by other fish or they have baby fish. So lots of things can be tracked as numbers changing over time, and those are the ones calculus is good at describing.
Uh-huh. That's fascinating to me. I had never heard calculus described that way, and it seemed very poetic.
Oh, good. Well, that, you know, that's something that I was trying to get across a little bit in this book about my teacher. There's a different teacher. I guess we'll start talking about him.
Yes, we will.
Uh-huh. That this is a story of a friendship and a relationship that evolved over 30 years. And the heart of it was that my teacher, Mr. Joffrey, and I, he was my calculus teacher in high school, we both loved doing calculus problems and showing our answers to each other or even interesting questions. But there seemed to be, as you say, a kind of poetic dimension to it, because here we were studying calculus, and meanwhile this relationship itself was sort of an object of change. That is, it was changing over the... just like anybody's relationship with anyone changes over the course of 30 years.
Yeah, yeah. Now, your correspondence with Mr. Joffrey, or Joff, as you ended up calling him, began in March of 77 when you were a freshman in college. Do you recall what prompted you to start writing to him? Because you didn't get very personal, especially in the early letters.
I don't really know why I wrote to him at first. And a lot of the beginning of our relationship was hazy. That is, it's not clear when did it begin. I mean, I was a student in his class. And that was in my junior year of high school. In my senior year, I didn't take a class with him, so I sort of almost lost touch with him a little bit. It's not like he was my mentor. He wasn't the teacher who meant the most to me. You know, a lot of people out there listening will be thinking of some mentor who really changed their life. I wouldn't say he was that person for me. Maybe more that geometry, that guy with the triangle, Mr. Johnson, was the one maybe that I would say was pivotal. But Mr. Joffrey was just a nice man who, you know, he taught me this course. We sort of fell out of touch. And then strangely, I found myself in college wanting to write to him and not to other teachers that meant more to me. So I don't really know. And I'm not even sure I know why to this day.
Did you think he was a peer in regard to your mathematical explorations, and you felt comfortable?
He wasn't at that point. Maybe I should say a little more about him. This might give a clue to me and you about why
okay.
did I write to him. He did a few things that were unique of all among teachers I'd ever seen. And one of them was that he would talk in a reverential way about his former students. Like, he was awestruck by the talent of people that he taught for, in the end, 50 years or so at this school.
Mm-hmm.
But he would talk about former students who had done something clever, and he would say, you know, I remember the time Jamie Williams found a formula for the Fibonacci numbers. And in his telling, this guy, I knew Jamie Williams. He was a skinny kid who was a pole vaulter on the track team. But the way Mr. Joffrey talked about him, it was like this was Isaac Newton in our midst. And, you know, I never saw a teacher so openly admire his students. It took so much humility and generosity to do that. So
mm-hmm.
I think there was a part of me that felt like, well, I like the way he talked about Jamie Williams, and maybe he'll talk, I don't know if it's just that I want him to talk about me like that now that I'm gone, or was it just that I thought he was a generous, you know, man I want to keep, or maybe I want to show off, maybe I want to show him what I'm learning in college. I'm not really sure. You know, is it like you want your parent to approve of you?
Yeah, it might have been all those things.
Could have been all of those
yeah,
things.
Yeah, yeah. Now, back to your biography, though. At one point in your book, you talk about how your brother Ian talked you into becoming a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
And you became very uncomfortable, and yet you tried to pursue it. Talk to us a little bit about that. And that really changed you into where you wanted to be.
True. Well, that's right. So for a long time, I was sort of, I guess I would say, a good boy. I think I still am, kind of. I'm 50 years old now. But that is, I did what I was told, largely. I wasn't a rebellious kid. I always liked math and science. But as I mentioned, I also liked English and French and everything else. And so mm-hmm. I was happy in school. because of that, it felt like there were a number of different directions I could take my life. And my parents, who had not gone to college and, you know, grew up in the Depression and had that kind of life that a lot of our parents did of that generation, you know, they said, wouldn't it be nice for you to be a doctor? My mother always said, look, it's a nice life. It has science in it. You could take care of people. You're sweet. You have nice hands. She used to always say, look at your nice long fingers. So, I mean, that was the level of understanding that she had about what kind of career would make sense. But my brother, who was more sophisticated, my older brother, 12 years older, was a lawyer, and he said, you know, look, you really ought to think about being a doctor because truth is, you probably would like it. And I had been resisting. I mean, I just said a minute ago I wasn't rebellious, so maybe there was a little rebelliousness in me because I resisted all these pushes to be pre-med and to take all those courses because I was pretty passionate about math and physics at that point in my life. Now, as a junior in college, I always saw myself as being a math teacher by then. I mean, so this idea to be a doctor, I never really wanted to do biology or cut open, you know, the frog and look in there. It wasn't my kind of thing. So,
but you did it anyway for a while.
I did. He persuaded me. His argument was pretty good. It was that you don't have to commit to being a doctor. You just have to take these pre-med courses. It'd be much easier to take them now than later. And if you just take them, it keeps your options open, and maybe you'll like it and maybe you won't, but at least you'll learn some good science. So why not try it? And so I did. Mm-hmm. And
your mother discovered how unhappy you were.
Exactly. It took many months of going through these courses, and there was a course to prepare for the medical boards, and that required driving an hour every Sunday morning to some place where these preparation courses were offered. And it was a big drag being a pre-med. It was a competitiveness.
Especially if you don't want to be a doctor.
I didn't want to do it. But I was doing it. It took months and months of my life. The worst was probably for me doing three labs a week. I'd had biology lab, chemistry lab, organic chemistry, all at the same time. And I'm not good in the lab. I couldn't boil water even to save my life. So anyway,
we're glad you didn't go into medicine.
Well, everyone should be glad I never became a doctor. but anyway, I did come home for maybe it was spring break. So, you know, 3/4 of the way through the year. And my mother just looked at my face and said, what's wrong? Your face doesn't look right. Mm-hmm. And I said, I don't know. Maybe I'm tired. She said, no. Something's really bothering you. What? And so we started to talk about it for a while, and gradually it emerged that what was bothering me so much was that I would never get to take quantum mechanics, which is this very esoteric, this is the science of the atom. Uh-huh. Like as a little boy.
A little boy wanted to do that exactly from 6 years old.
Right. So this boy from 6 years old was now getting the chance to learn the real story about atomic physics, and the boy was not going to ever get a chance to do it because he was going to become a pre-med and have to take all these other courses instead. Uh-huh. So when she said to me, how would you feel if right now you could just say, look, I just want to be a math professor. I want to take quantum mechanics. I want to take advanced math courses. I'm not going to be a pre-med. I'm not going to be a doctor. I'm going to do what I want. I'm going to be the best professor I can be. And I just started crying. I just like burst out into tears. Uh-huh. This weight was lifted from me. Yeah. And my mother started crying. And we neither of us exactly knew what we were crying about. And then we were laughing. And it was just this kind of epiphany, thanks to having a very good mother who listened to me and could see what was wrong, could see something in my face. Most good parents can do that.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, she did that. And from that day on, I never had any second thoughts. I never really looked back.
So that was calculus in motion, change within a second.
That kind of abrupt change, you know, I mean, that was almost like a tipping point sort of experience. I don't know, calculus has trouble with those very radical sudden changes, but you're right, it certainly was a dramatic change.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Stephen Strogatz. We're talking about his book, The Calculus of Friendship. Now, in a 1980 letter to Mr. Joffrey, you said that you're still planning to get a PhD, to get married, become a professor, learn for the rest of your life, and live more or less happily ever after. We could already see the trajectory of that line. Tell us why you decided to be so honest in this book about your failings.
Well, I'm struck actually with that little quote that you read. That's me writing at, I don't remember, what year is it?
1980.
So I was 21 years old. And, you know, I guess what I would want you to take from that is the optimism of youth and the naivete of youth that, you know, is life really that simple that I can just plan my whole life? I knew, I said more or less happily ever after. I guess I anticipated
you were realistic.
Things could happen. But yeah, I'm still 21 and I have no idea what's coming. In fact, in the years to come, things would happen to both me and Mr. Joffrey, some very good happy things, some mm-hmm. very tragic things. In his case especially, he had a son who was his oldest son,
yeah.
And this son, Marshall, died when he was only 27 years old.
And you weren't able to write to him about that.
I didn't know what to do about that. Yeah. I heard about it, and Mr. Joffrey didn't mention it to me. Our letters were not like that. Maybe I should clarify that these letters back and forth between us were about math problems.
Mm-hmm.
And he would write a problem, and I would, often he'd ask for help to how to solve a problem. Sometimes a question would come up that one of his best students had asked him, and he didn't know how to answer. And he would then consult with me. How would I look at it?
Mm-hmm.
And this was a great pleasure for me. I mean, this was ecstasy, really, because I wanted to teach math. And now I had a student. You know, I wasn't old and wasn't a professor yet, so I had no students. Mr. Joffrey was my student. And by extension, his students became my students. So this was very thrilling. And so we were happy writing back and forth about math, but it was a very compartmentalized relationship. And when these good or bad things would happen to both of us, we didn't talk about it much, but except that I'd somehow heard about his son.
Mm-hmm. And in the meantime, you got divorced and
all kinds of things happened. But I mean, the thing with the son, because it's an important part of the book is that I think of my own life, that I didn't know what to say. And I feel very ashamed about, I never sent a letter of condolence. Mm-hmm. I never said anything to him. He didn't mention it to me. And I feel very guilty about it to this day. And I'm not sure I deserve to feel guilty because all of us have friends who have either lost children or their parents, or,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and who knows what to say to them. Now, when you're old enough, and this has happened to you enough, either in your own life or your friends' lives, you start to learn that it doesn't take much. You just have to say, I'm really sorry to hear what happened,
yep.
or
yep.
you're just there for them. Well, I didn't even know to do that, and I think I was scared of saying something wrong and making it worse for him,
yeah.
or that I would make him start crying, or that it would hurt, or, you know, who knows what. Or maybe I just didn't know what to say. So maybe I shouldn't have felt guilty, but I still do. And I think I was very self-absorbed in the sense that I'm not even sure it occurred to me to say anything to him.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm telling it now like I didn't know what to say. It's very possible that I didn't even think to say anything, which would be a lot worse.
Mm-hmm.
So
I think you worked it out in the book. I really do.
Well, maybe so. But I mean, there was this aspect of writing the book that was a bit terrifying to me. And I don't mean the difficulty of writing. What I mean is that I wrote these letters to Mr. Joffrey over this 30-year span from the time I was about 15 to, well, actually now it's almost 35 years, from about 15 to 50. And I hadn't, you know, keep in mind, I mailed the letters. I didn't see them again. They were sitting in, he saved them for some reason.
Uh-huh.
But I haven't seen some of these letters for 30 something years. And meanwhile, when he would write to me, I would throw his letters away because they didn't mean anything to me. I thought this was a relationship about math problems. So I didn't save most of his. And meanwhile, he's saving mine. And when I finally realized that there might be a story here about a friendship that's more than just a collection of math problems, I asked him for my old letters back. And that's the terrifying part, that I wondered, what am I going to find out about my old self, about how immature I was or how insensitive or self-absorbed or whatever. And so when I would look at some of those letters, like for instance, after I know that, you know, around the time that his son died, I was looking with great trepidation at what did I say? And as I look at my letters, I'm not saying anything.
Yeah, yeah.
That was disturbing.
But maybe it helped him by keeping him preoccupied with some of your math problems.
Well, that's right. This relationship did have that side to it, that it was a refuge for both of us from, mm-hmm. Especially maybe for him, from some of the non-ideal things that happen in the real world.
Yeah.
You know, in math, it's all perfect.
Yeah, exactly. Now, let's talk about some of the work you've done in the ensuing years. You and your students were part of the 6 degrees of separation game. To talk to us about that. Everybody knows that about as the Kevin Bacon game.
Yeah, the Kevin Bacon game. So we've heard this phrase, 6 degrees of separation, and it's this, in a way, a very reassuring or comforting idea that we're all very close on this earth, that even though there's 6 or 7 billion people, we're only 6 handshakes away from everybody on Earth. There's a mathematical aspect to that which struck me and my student Duncan Watts, that how is that possible? We only know a few hundred people each. How could we be that closely connected to all 7 billion on Earth? Is it even true? And if it is true, what would the world's social network have to be like, you know, in an abstract sense, as a bunch of dots connected by lines,
mm-hmm.
where a person is a dot and a line between two dots means those two people know each other. What would that enormous thicket of dots and lines be like to have the 6 degrees property? That was one thought. But then there was a second thought, which was really Duncan's idea, which was that this is much more than a problem about a curiosity of social life. This is about everything. When someone gets on an airplane and spreads HIV to the United States from Africa, or when the banking system has a problem and failures start to propagate from the subprime mortgage market to the whole economy, when a few neurons in the brain start to fire and suddenly there's a conscious thought or a feeling. You know, I mean, everything around us is really a gigantic network, whether it's nervous systems, genes, banks, ecosystems. And so that was the big thought that really I have to give a lot of credit to Duncan Watts for thinking of, that if we could understand the 6 degrees property of networks, we would be solving many important scientific problems in one stroke.
Is that a subject that you're still working with?
Yeah, I never was trained in network theory and was a little nervous to get into it when Duncan brought up these ideas because I knew I was a beginner at it. But to this day, there are people who, I mean, if you look at my Wikipedia page, you will say I'm known for my work in network theory, which always makes me laugh because I'm still a beginner at it. But we just sort of blundered into it and found something interesting.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, that's, everybody knows about that. Now, what about your work on the wobbling of London's Millennium Bridge? Can you tell us about that? That's fascinating to me, too.
Oh, well, thanks. So the Millennium Bridge, as some people will know who've been to London recently, it's a beautiful footbridge across the Thames built to commemorate the year 2000. It's very thin. It looks almost like a ribbon across the river. It's as if you strung a guitar string taut across the river and then hung a platform from it, a very thin, just a few meters wide platform for people to walk across. So this bridge is this very minimalist, elegant structure, and England was very proud of it when it opened on June 10th, 2000, and thousands of people came from all over the country. The Queen was there, BBC was there to film this first new bridge across the Thames in 100 years and watch as the crowd streamed onto the bridge to enjoy it. And as soon as the people started walking on the bridge, it did something that nobody anticipated, which is it started to shake sideways. Now, that's really strange.
I remember that, yeah.
Oh, you do?
Oh, I do. I remember the news story.
It was very embarrassing. And the architect was pointing fingers at the engineers, and no one really knew why this was happening. And some people, you know, were sort of chuckling at it because a lot of people thought this was an arrogant design. It looked almost like the bare minimum of structure was there. It was like this bridge was missing everything it needed to be a bridge. Of course it's going to have stability problems, thought some engineers. In fact, what was happening on the Millennium Bridge was that something unprecedented was occurring, which is that people were interacting with the bridge in a way that no one had ever seen before. Now, specifically what happened is that the people inadvertently started to feel the slight sideways wobbling of the bridge. For whatever reason, maybe the bridge is jiggling just a little bit. Could be air, you know, the wind, could be, who knows? I mean, if you've walked on any suspension bridge, you know that
it's a little bit scary.
A little bit.
Yeah.
So that wouldn't be a problem. But this bridge, as it, for whatever reason, is jiggling a little bit sideways. It turned out that people started to change their gait in a way that made them feel more comfortable. Sort of like if you stand up in a rowboat and it wobbles a little, you might adjust, maybe you spread your feet a little wider to keep your balance. So as people did that, they inadvertently pumped some energy into the bridge, making it wobble more sideways, which made more people change their gait to balance and inadvertently pump more energy in. So there became this runaway feedback effect where eventually thousands of people were synchronized with the motion of the bridge, walking in sync in a way that was making the bridge move a lot sideways and really scary and uncomfortable.
Oh, I'll bet it was.
Dangerous.
Yeah.
It turned out the bridge didn't collapse and nobody got hurt, but the bridge had to be closed 2 days later and stayed closed for about a year and a half and had to be repaired at a cost of many millions of dollars.
But did you figure out mathematically why this happened?
Well, we did, I suppose. I mean, there were theories out there that it had, you could see the people were synchronized. The BBC filmed what was happening and you could see whole sections of the crowd rocking in unison. Now, keep in mind, these are not soldiers marching in step. Some people will be thinking, oh, I've heard about bridges and, you know, soldiers are told to break step when they cross a bridge.
Yeah.
This is not that, because for one thing, these are not soldiers. These are people who spontaneously, you know, grandmothers and little kids are just spontaneously walking in sync. The other thing is that soldiers, when they march in step, push a bridge up and down, making it wobble vertically, whereas this bridge is moving sideways, which is really unusual.
Mm.
So there was some feeling in the engineering community that there was something about the synchronization of the people that was causing the problem and their interaction with the bridge. But nobody really knew why would the people synchronize and why did the bridge start moving in the first place. And so our work with my student Danny Abrams was to show mathematically how it could be that as people walk and adjust their gait, they could both drive the bridge and spontaneously synchronize to its motion.
God, that's amazing. That's absolutely amazing. Now, we only have a couple minutes left. You received a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Joint Policy Board of Mathematicians for your ability to communicate about mathematics to the general public. Are you still seeing how afraid the general public is of math and numbers? How do you compensate for that?
Maybe it's getting a little better. That TV show, Numbers, is a surprise to me.
Mm-hmm.
So many people watch the show. It's on Friday nights at 10, and it seems to be, I think it's the number one show in its time slot. So now, of course, it is a crime show. It's a brother works in the FBI, and his brother's a mathematician. But still, it's got a lot of math in it,
uh-huh.
and it does a decent job of conveying the math. So maybe there's a little bit of willingness to among the general public to put up with mathematical ideas or even enjoy them. But still, seriously, I mean, it is a bit of a cause for concern that the country as a whole, you know, maybe a little more seriously than television, we're not that serious about math education and science.
Yeah, indeed.
That is, a lot of people will say to their kids, you know, look, I wasn't any good in math either, and you don't really need it.
Mm-hmm.
And the trouble is that there's a lot of truth to that. You don't really need math to be a functioning citizen. And so a lot of very well-educated people will admit to you that they don't know anything about math and don't understand it, and they get by just fine.
Mm-hmm.
So you could say, well, so what, right? I mean, maybe only engineers and scientists and some computer people need to know it, and the rest of us can ignore it. And there's probably some truth to that, but I'm not sure that that's sustainable, because the way we've been living for a long time is we use people from India and China and Korea who come here in countries where they care very much about math and make sure that all students learn it.
That's right,
yeah. And their parents tell them it's important. And, you know, another thing, too, is that in those countries, the parents tell the kids it's hard, but you can do it, and if you work hard, you can do it. Whereas our parents, I mean, I'm not making this up. Studies have shown that if you ask American parents why can't their kid do math, they'll say, my kid isn't talented.
Mm.
That it's, you know, that doesn't have a head for math.
A lot of people still think math is genius territory,
yeah,
don't
exactly.
they?
Exactly. They think it's some kind of genius thing. They think it's innate. You're either good at it or you're not. The Japanese and Korean and Chinese parents don't, or Indian parents say, no, everyone can do math. You just have to work really hard.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
until we get that attitude, I think we're going to have trouble. As those countries start to prosper, especially India and China, which are really coming on strong,
they are.
Those students are going home and are going to work in the engineering and science fields for them. And we better figure out a way to start educating our own people. Or, you know, I mean, there's that aspect of it. There's also just the sense of what a pity it is that, just like music and art are beautiful, and it enriches your life to understand those things and to appreciate them. Math is like that, too.
Yeah.
And it's just a great loss in terms of appreciation of beauty that so few of us really get it.
Yeah. Well, Stephen Strogatz, we have run out of time. I thank you so much for joining us. And I do recommend the book. I hope everybody will go out and get it. It's called The Calculus of Friendship, What a Teacher and Student Learned About Life While Corresponding About Math. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Tish. It was a great pleasure.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. If you'd like to make a tax-deductible donation in support of the Out of Bounds radio show, please contact our fiscal sponsor, the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes, at earts.org. That's earts.org. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.